is Kathleen St. John. I'm counsel for the plaintiff appellant, Sue Spadafon. I would like to reserve 3 minutes time for rebuttal. This case involves a relatively simple set of facts and circumstances. On March 5th, 1997, the trial court issued an order based upon a motion of the defendant ordering the plaintiff to file a more definite statement by March 14th, 1997. The plaintiff did not file a more definite statement by March 14th, but did so 10 weeks late, and filed it on May 27th, 1997. It was filed that date, it was walked up to the trial court, and 3 days later, the trial court dismissed the action with prejudice pursuant to Civil Rule 41B1 for failure to comply, to timely comply with the court order.
Our rule is...
When the original motion for a more definite statement was filed, did the court issue or granted that request? Did it at that time say that if there is compliance by a certain date, this case will be dismissed?
If I understand Your Honor correctly, you're referring to the first time
the
action was filed.
Initially.
Yeah, the action was initially filed on April 4th or 5th of 1995. The defendant's immediate response was to file a motion for a more definite statement. The court granted that motion and at that time did say that sanctions, including dismissal, could be granted for failure to timely comply. She gave the plaintiff 30 days, and within that 30 days, the plaintiff did file a more definite statement. That first action didn't tend very long. It tended about 5 months until September of 1995, at which time the plaintiff took a 41A1A voluntary dismissal. Does that answer Your Honor's question?
Yes.
The case was refiled then in September of 1996. It didn't really get active again until February of 1997, when the trial court scheduled a case management conference. And it was in this brief 2.5 month period after that time that this particular motion was granted and the 10 week late file of more definite statement occurred.
Our rule has always been, and the cases have always held, that if there's a less restrictive sanction, that sanction should be imposed.
Absolutely.
How far does the trial court have to go before they can finally get to the ultimate sanction? I mean, this was persistent, was it not?
We don't believe that this was persistent. I know that that's what the Court of Appeals indicated, and that is what the appellee has argued. But we believe that the only violations on this record began at March 14th, 1997, and took us up through that 10-week period until the more definite statement was filed. At the same time, there was another belated conduct on the part of plaintiff's counsel, which consisted of failing to respond to interrogatories. On April 25th, 1997, the defendant filed two motions, the motion to compel responses to interrogatories and the motion to dismiss for failure to timely file a more definite statement. Shortly after receiving that, the court's response to those two motions was to rule upon one. On May 9, 1997, the court granted the motion to compel and ordered the plaintiff to comply within 14 days. That order was not mailed until May 19, and shortly after receiving that, plaintiff's counsel complied with everything. So really, contrary to appellee's position, there wasn't a continuing course of conduct here. There were no non-compliances that in the first time the action was filed in those first 5 months. It was only in this period from approximately March 14th until May 27th that the plaintiff's counsel had lagged behind and not complied timely with these orders. So there was full compliance, and the full compliance occurred then on May 27th, at which time the discovery was produced and the court was notice of this fact. The motion to dismiss was opposed by saying it's now moot because we have now filed our more definite statement, and a very detailed, more definite statement was filed showing that there was clear merit, if the allegations alleged proved to be true, clear merits to the legal malpractice case, which is the underlying action at issue here. And again, with respect to less drastic sanctions, the case law, the Court of Appeals in this state, the Ninth District is particularly active on this proposition of law, our first proposition of law, and they have frequently stated that before resorting to this harshest sanction of dismissal, it is incumbent upon the trial court to consider what other sanctions they can impose. Clearly here there's attorney error, and clearly the sanction could have been leveled at the attorney. Whether that consisted of a reprimand, whether that consisted of a motion to show cause order, where the attorney would have to appear and show cause as to why she shouldn't be fined. But those are the kind of sanctions that could remedy this kind of conduct without destroying the plaintiff's cause of action.
Counsel?
Yes.
Other than finding abuse of discretion, what new law do you have a strike for? We have law that says there should be legislation imposed where there is. We grant the courts a lot of control over their docket. We could get 100,000 cases like this one. Went a little bit, went too far, went too much. Disagree with where the judge dismisses along the chain in favor of the prosecutor. What law do you write?
I would think that our first proposition of law would be a new statement for civil dis law in a civil action from this court. The proposition that a trial court should consider less severe sanctions before leveling the ultimate sanction of dismissal with prejudice it exists as Court of Appeals law, but it does not exist as civil dis law in a civil action from this court. And I think that with this kind of, this is a very touchy area of law, and I think that the both the bench and the bar need very structured rules to guide them. And again, although that is a very firm law in the federal system, and it repeatedly reappears in the Court of Appeals opinions, it's kind of been talked about in an ancillary way in some of this court's decisions. It is not civil dis law at this time. I would also think that with respect to our third proposition of law, with respect to the procedural safeguards, that although this court has indicated that notice is a necessary due process or due course of law procedural safeguard, that a drastic remedy or a drastic sanction such as this really should require a hearing. And I think that Justice Resnick in the Industrial Risk versus Lorenz case had indicated that in a concurring opinion, that really when we're looking at whether or not trial courts abuse his or her discretion, we need to see a record. We need to see the plaintiff's excuses, the plaintiff's evidence, the defendant's rebuttal, and the trial court's thought process. Because here, it is clear that the court dismissed this action for one reason and one reason alone, non-timely compliance with an order to file a more definite statement.
Do we not encourage attorney misconduct and attorney dilatory tactics by such a motion? Do we look to the malpractice system to solve attorneys that later can convey to us like this?
First of all, I respectfully disagree with Your Honor's interpretation of this case as being flagrant. I think that this was a busy attorney who simply got a little out of control at the time, but I don't think that this is a flagrant abuse as might have existed in, I think it's the Industrial Risk versus Lorenz case where there's years and years of abuses.
Let me just, before you leave that, is the Court of Appeals then overstating that issue when it says plaintiff appellant repeatedly ignored orders of the trial court with little or no justification presented, including the order to file a more definite statement? Is that the trial court was left a little alternative at that point to dismiss the action? Is that an overstatement? Is that a misreading of what happened by the Court of Appeals?
I respectfully submit that it is. I really think if you study this record, you'll find absolutely no misconduct on the part of the plaintiff in the first action filed. And in the second action filed, it really wasn't reactivated until February of 1997. And the first deadline that plaintiff failed to comply with was that March 14th deadline. And 2 months later, the action is being dismissed. So there might have been two non-compliances, and again, they were matters of not complying with deadline. Substantively, by May 27th, all the non-compliances were remedied. But there's no other non-compliance on the record apart from those two. I did want to finish responding to Justice Lundberg's dragging question. With respect to will we be essentially eviscerating the trial court's authority to control its docket, and will counsel be abusing the system? I don't believe so. First of all, I don't think that any attorney would relish the idea of either a monetary sanction or a reprimand or some other sanction directed at his or her conduct. Secondly, because the courts of appeals frequently follow this, our first proposition of law, because the federal system almost universally follows it, obviously it's a proposition that works. It controls conduct without drastically hampering the due process rights of the client. Secondly, should we encourage further litigation to remedy something that could be remedied by a lesser sanction from the trial court? It doesn't really make sense to invite a second lawsuit as a penalty for something that could have been corrected with a lesser sanction in the first action. Our second proposition of law has to do with the notice issue. And in this case, we submit that there wasn't proper notice. Now, I don't believe that the notice in the first action could serve to put the plaintiff on notice in the second action. In the first action, notice was given, 30 days to file, plaintiff complied. So at that point in time, it's a dead issue. We get to the second action. The March 5th order, there was no express language about sanctions or the ultimate sanction of dismissal. The first possible time the plaintiff was on notice was April 25th, when the defendant filed a motion to dismiss for failure to timely comply with the order.
Should we take note that the rule for Rule 12E, which is the rule relating to more definite statement, telegraphs the sanction of dismissal? Should we take note of that? I think the rule speaks to that it can be dismissed. You think not?
I'm not sure. So, because I think that the Civil Rule 41D1 requires notice issuing from the trial court. I mean, to always be on notice that a failure to comply with the rule would result in a sanction of dismissal would effectively...
The potential, I guess we just would say it would, our rule would be whether or not there's a notice of a potential for dismissal or
right.
for a violation of a rule that speaks to it or a court order.
Right, but if every time, that would essentially eviscerate the plaintiff's right to notice, because I mean, essentially attorneys know that they're supposed to be complying with deadlines, filing things on time. You're basically saying you don't need notice because you always know that you're in danger of being sanctioned. I don't think that would be a workable rule.
Yeah. We have to keep in mind, I guess you would want us to keep in mind what the law we write about this subject also has to encompass the potential for non-lawyers, for individuals representing themselves.
Absolutely, and all the more so reason that the party should be given express, unambiguous notice from the court, because otherwise they may not be sophisticated enough to realize the potential for dismissal with respect to belated compliance. I think what's really important with respect to the notice issue is that we're dealing with a situation where there was compliance. The purpose of notice is to give the offending party or their attorney one last opportunity to comply or explain the noncompliance. In this case, when the plaintiff was on implied notice, the plaintiff did comply. After that, there's nothing more that the party can do to correct what went wrong. And in this case, it was only after that party complied that the court dismissed for failure timely to comply. In that circumstance, whatever notice existed from the filing of the motion to dismiss had resolved itself because the plaintiff did comply. At the very least, further notice would have to be given at this point in time. And again, I would suggest that the proper procedure at this point in time would be a hearing or other opportunity to allow the plaintiff to defend, the plaintiff's attorney to defend her conduct and to attempt to make reparations and to satisfy the court that henceforth the action will go forward in a proper manner.
Thank you, Ms. McGann.
Thank you.
Mr. Brick.
My name is Tim Brick, and this is all Tim Whitford. I represent Paul Telephone, sitting behind the table here. I would like to start out by saying that the issue before this court is whether the trial court abused its discretion in dismissing the plaintiff's sanctions for failing to obey and comply with orders of the court and other discovery abuses. I think this is an important issue. Goes to the heart of what kind of authority the trial courts in the state should have to control and monitor their docket and to make sure that the cases proceed in an orderly fashion. I think it's also important because this case will impact the ability of litigants in a civil lawsuit, both defendants and plaintiffs, to proceed with their cases and how they were going to handle them when they are faced with an opponent that is abusing the process, such as we clearly believe happened in this case. The 8th District Court of Appeals has a thorough opinion in this case. It did not gloss over the facts of this case. They went into detail all of the abuses that we believe occurred, and I think that was the only reason the opinion ought to be affirmed by this court. I say that under the abuse of discretion standard that I believe applies here, the issue is whether the trial court acted arbitrarily or unconscionably. Certainly that is not the case. Due respect to Ms. St. John here, she was not involved in the representation that led to the dismissal. She's been faced with a difficult task here of trying to do some damage control from prior counsel. And I think that we definitely believe that the abuses in this case were persistent, they were flagrant, that the counsel acted irresponsibly, was flouting the rules of civil procedure as well as the orders of the court, and that the sanction was appropriate. There's a long list of abuses that I'd like to agree with just to make sure that you understand. When the case was filed, the first case, there was an order that for a more definite statement than that sanction would be imposed if it was not done. That was done. The case was dismissed, but yet at the refiling, same vague, ambiguous complaint that required the initial more definite statement to file. After that, an order was put out by the trial court to file another motion for a more definite statement. The trial court ordered that be done, and the counsel totally ignored that order. As far as conducting discovery,
this whole thing is what we're considering issues cases.
Okay, the point was they basically said that Mr. Chubb was a lawyer, he represented the plaintiff, he committed malpractice. So we need more than that.
Thank you.
I don't know if this court is aware of the surrounding facts case, but it's kind of washing of this crazy litigation, the wiretap litigation is going on in prison. I know that this case has been up before this court several times with Mr. Collins and Mr. Nix, and so it was an unusual case. We felt that we needed more than just the blanket proposition that he was a lawyer and had committed malpractice, and that was the reason for that. We felt it was necessary. And so in the court, which is why the order was issued. As far as the discovery goes, counsel totally refused to cooperate. Discovery was issued and ignored. Phone calls were not returned. Letters were not responded to. A motion to compel was filed. There was no response to that.
Was that in the first case or the second case?
and the court granted that motion to compel and noted that sanctions would be employee dismissal appropriate and wasn't a response.
So you're saying it exceeded the one incident that she discussed?
Yes. So there was clear discovery abuses in the case. And I think another point that was that needs to be brought out is that all of this was done. Never has there ever been any excuse by counsel as to why that there was no compliance with the orders, why there was discovery abuses. There was never an affidavit or even a letter. There is nothing in the record to suggest that the counsel's docket was full or that she was ill and couldn't do anything. And I think that's an important factor because it shows the counsel was just flouting the orders of the court and was not seriously following the rules of discovery or the court's order, and that sanction was appropriate.
Counselor, I noticed that the Court of Appeals didn't cite Moore versus Emanuel Family Training. And in that case, we said, in conclusion, we reiterate our longstanding belief that the interests of justice are better served when Ohio's courts address the merits of claims and defenses at issue. And then this, the extremely harsh sanction of dismissal should be reserved for cases when an attorney's conduct falls substantially below what is reasonable under the circumstances, evidencing a complete disregard for the judicial system or the rights of the opposing party. That happen here?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's exactly what happened in this case. This was a flagrant abuse by counsel that I understand that the merits of the case, that of course, that those are important and that should be the goal of every lawsuit that's filed to decide on the merits. But I think you have to temper that with the trial court's ability to manage the docket, the authority to control what's going on. And this is not a case where it was a simple one-time mistake. This was repeated violations. It was
in the second case.
Absolutely.
So it was really a disregard, you're saying, for the judicial system.
I think it falls within that category. Absolutely right.
Okay, moving to the second issue, just quickly, there's a concurrence in that opinion. A concurrence that I wrote. It says such lack of notice is a clear violation of the rule, and thus the cases should be reversed for further proceedings. It's conceded in these cases there is no notice of intent to dismiss ever given to plaintiff's counsel. Was there a notice of intent in the second case to dismiss ever given to plaintiff's counsel?
That's the whole notice issue of Quasicut, and that I think that this case is distinguishable from the Moore case. Absolutely, the counsel was aware that the case was subject to dismissal.
Well, that isn't the issue. Your case is always subject to dismissal. Your case is always subject to dismissal if a judge chooses to dismiss it. The issue is it proper? But 41B1 clearly says there has to be notice, and we've subsequently held that. Yes. Was there direct notice to plaintiff's counsel that the case was going to be dismissed?
Well, an order from the court, is that what your question is? Did I file a motion to dismiss?
Not an order. Judge sends you a note, or the judge... I think we finally said it had to be in writing, but they send you a citation that the case is going to be subject to dismissal unless you do thus and so.
Well, I think there's three ways that goes to is satisfied in this case. First, in the original case of the motion for a more definite statement, there was an order that if you don't do that within the time frame, that will be dismissed. Secondly, there was an order in the motion to compel, granted motion to compel, that said sanctions including dismissal would be appropriate. And finally, defense counsel myself filed a motion to dismiss asking that the case be dismissed as a sanction for failing to comply with the orders. For the counsel to get up and say that, gee, we didn't know that that there was any danger of the case being dismissed, I think that's totally disingenuous. And it's just not right.
That motion to which the response was filed late, your motion dismissed, yes. The response to the Court of Appeals has this all cited on page 9, at least 9 in the appendix, I guess. So that's your point seems to be that you filed a motion dismissed, there was no response to it within the 10-day rule.
Correct.
And so what's the appellant complaining about?
Absolutely.
They knew that there was a motion dismissed. They didn't respond to it.
That's right. And I think, Judge, there's further evidence that the counsel was flouting the rules. And I agree with the Court of Appeals' assertion that, and I take issue with the claim that, gee, we did comply with the rules. There was no compliance. The Court of Appeals noted that. and was whatever was done was too little, too late.
Were any of those notices of dismissal indicate that they would be dismissed with prejudice?
Yes, I believe so.
I noticed that you ticked off three notices, and I didn't hear you say that.
Certainly, my motion was the motion that I filed.
Not the motion. The notice from the court. You said the court, gave notice to the plaintiff that if these things weren't done, it was going to be dismissed. Didn't you say that?
Yes, yes.
Did the court say that the dismissal would be with prejudice?
I don't have, certainly in the second case, I don't believe that there was, although...
Is there a difference?
Not in this case, because I believe since there had been a voluntary dismissal, that the second dismissal would have acted on the merits whether it was with prejudice or without prejudice. So, frankly speaking, I don't think that the word with prejudice or without prejudice would make any difference in this case.
Isn't this dismissal a serious dismissal? In other words, the case is over. Don't you think that the court should have a hearing to determine whether or not there are any reasons or any things that happened in the case that the court does not know about?
So I'll tell you why I don't think that's necessary. All right. I think that this court's decision in Quantum made it clear to counsel in Ohio that he must obey the rules of discovery as well as the orders of the court or face the consequences of potential dismissal. I think that's a clear message that was sent by this court, and that needs to be strengthened, not retreated from.
Is there any situation that the court should have a hearing before dismissing the case?
Wanted to have a hearing, then I think that would be within their discretion. But to make that mandatory, I think that what will happen is that you will find that that counsel will just ignore the rules until the end. They're given the second chance. Nothing can really bad happen to me until
A hearing doesn't say you're not going to get dismissed in the long run anyhow. Just by having a hearing, that doesn't eliminate the dismissal, but it gives more credibility to the court if after a hearing on the things that they didn't know about, they still dismiss it with prejudice, doesn't it?
I can tell you, Judge, that I think this is what happens. This case is an example of what happens when the rule is second chance. We have to put a written notice out. That's what Quantum Hub is all about. That type of rule, an absolute requirement, they let the counsel basically ignore orders, commit discovery abuses with the feeling that this could be rectified at the end, and until, I don't have to get serious until there's an order out that there's going to be a hearing when the court gives me an order of dismissal. And I think that is what happened. I think the Quantum Hub was a step in the right direction. Attorneys are on notice now that they do have to take the orders to the court seriously.
Go ahead, Justice.
It appears, though, that in the central entry, the trial judge refers back to volume 2055, page 659, and in that entry where it says motion for a more definite statement filed October 28, 1996, granted plaintiff to file a more definite statement by March 14, 1997. This was entered by the trial judge on February 28, 1997. It doesn't appear that there's any mention by the trial judge in that particular entry that non-compliance will result in dismissal.
Well, they said, Judge, there was an order within the order.
In the earlier order,
so I think there was plenty of notice. I don't think this is really a notice issue. I think the notice was clearly satisfied on the part of the I also think that there was enough dilatory conduct on the part of the plaintiff's counsel, clear transgressions and flagrant abuses of both the discovery system and the judicial process, and that I believe that the Quantum Hub decision under that, that this should be a case that the court can use to strengthen the resolve and make it clear to members of the bar in Ohio that they must treat their cases seriously. The discovery abuses will not be tolerated. And for those reasons,
do you think under Quonset Hutt, your motion to dismiss is sufficient?
Absolutely.
I have much sympathy with your argument, because it's nothing more aggravating than somebody on your side that won't follow the rules and comply. But we're stuck with the rules too. And B1 specifically says, where the plaintiff fails to prosecute or comply with the rules or any court order, the court, upon motion of a defendant, that's what you're talking about, or in its own motion, may, after notice to the plaintiff's counsel, dismiss an action or claim. Right. So the filing of notice isn't enough. I mean, the filing of a motion isn't enough. The filing of a motion to compel isn't enough. The rule is very specific. After notice to the plaintiff's counsel. And we've held in a couple of cases that it has to be just that specific. When a court intends to order dismissal for a violation of the discovery rules, B1 requires the court to give prior notice of his intent to dismiss with prejudice. And that wasn't done here, really, was it?
I would say a couple of things. One, underlying interpretation clause and the implied notice, clearly there was implied notice here. So I'm giving this court's decision on that. I also say, point out that under Civil Rule 12E, that I think that there was certainly compliance with Civil Rule 12E, because under that rule, and certainly that there was no abuse of discretion in the court's decision in the case of the court. That Civil Rule.
Also, the entry of 5697 on the motion to the motion to file 525 was granted.
attorneys in the state of Ohio were on notice after Quantico that implied notice of dismissal was a potential. And Quantico came out in October of 1997. This dismissal happened in May of 1997, so counsel didn't have the benefit of the Quantico ruling. I would also like to point out that there's a heightened standard of abuse of discretion when you're dealing with 41B1 dismissals, and that is in the case of Jones versus Hartgrant. I think we need to limit ourselves to the facts on the record. Mr. Brick suggests that there were phone calls back and forth and so on, but those are statements of counsel in a brief, and they're not facts or evidence on the record. Mr. Brick didn't mention anything that really controverted what I said, that the abuses, such as they were, happened in that two-month period starting March 14th. The motion to compel that he was talking about was the very same motion to compel that I was talking about.
In our analysis of the abuse of discretion issue, should one of the factors be the extent of the tardiness of counsel? In your brief, the term that it was stated that counsel was not egregiously tardy,
right,
which sort of shook me, because is that our standard in Ohio?
We cited a Florida Court of Appeals case where the tardiness was 4 months, and the Court of Appeals reversed, finding that it was a similar situation as tardy filing of a more definite statement, and the Court of Appeals found that although that was abuse of the process, it wasn't the kind of egregious abuse that justified.
So timing, I mean, we shouldn't, the rules and the dates are, I guess you'd say, only when you're, I guess I'm thinking maybe tardy, not tardy, is how we should look at it. And
I understand that, and I'm just saying that there is a basis for sanctions, but not for the ultimate sanctions. I mean, essentially, the dismissal of prejudice for failure to prosecute is the civil equivalent of the death penalty. And the consul something very, very bad to warrant that ultimate sanction. And there should be intermediate levels of sanctioning before you get to that. And again, we continue to believe that there's not proper notice here, and that there should have been a hearing. I sympathize with Your Honor's concern about tardiness, and I'm not saying that 10 weeks is not tardy or...
Right, and I guess I needed you to answer, which you did, which is should the consideration of length of delay be a part of it?
Yes, is one of the factors to be considered, yes, Your Honor. I'm sure I don't have any more time, so I would respectfully request this Court to reverse the Court of Appeals and to remand the action for trial. Thank you.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised for opinion.